Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Just a few days ago, two of Vermont's health insurance companies, Blue Cross and MVP, filed for significant rate increases for their policies affecting individuals and small businesses in the state. Blue Cross is seeking an almost 10% increase. MVP is asking for a 15% increase. Betsy Bishop is the president of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. She says these increases are going to be very difficult for many businesses to deal with.
It's a disturbing trend to see that continue to rise to 10 to 15%. I know that a lot of small businesses have been struggling to pay for health care for their employees, and this type of premium increase is going to be difficult to absorb.
Why is this happening, and how will it affect the Green Mountain Care Board's effort to make health care more affordable for all Vermonters? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobay. Al, it's great to have you back.
Thank you, Bob. How are you?
Great. And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you have some thoughts about these proposed rate increases. How will they affect you? Do you think Vermont's going in the right direction on health care reform? Do you have some concerns? Or maybe is it a really good idea that coverage should be separated from employers? And maybe you have some thoughts about financing a single-payer system. Great opportunity to talk to Al Gobay today on all things health care. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So these are pretty hefty increases. Blue Cross, almost 10%. MVP, around 15%. Were you surprised by the size of these increases, or did you see it coming?
I don't want to say I saw it coming, but, you know, understanding the Affordable Care Act and the changes that are in it, understanding the trends in medical inflation, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised if they were, you know, higher than our medical inflation rate in the state. But no, I did not know what they would be ahead of time.
So we've got this situation when you break down the increase. Would it be fair to say that a majority of the increase in both cases are due to the Affordable Care Act? And how is that happening?
So I think that would be fair to say. The reason that's happening is, you get into a pretty detailed conversation about things like transitional reinsurance, which is a product in the Affordable Care Act that actually covered a portion of the spend that health insurers had to spend on claims for, you know, their customers. And so with that ratcheting away, that puts a cost driver on the insurer's rate, which is what we're seeing in these rates. But I want to be clear about something here. You know, the Green Mountain Care Board just received these rates. We have what I'm saying is about, you know, 84 days left to review them. We have a very public process to vet the assumptions in the rates, to educate the public about the assumptions, and to include public hearings that the public can attend, and a website where they can go and make comments to our board before we make a decision on any of the rates.
So do you look at these rates and do you think, well, you know, as you just mentioned, a good chunk of it is because of the Affordable Care Act, so that means a smaller part of it are medical costs, expenses in the state of Vermont. Is that the good news that people could read into this?
I think that, you know, Betsy's comments are right on. You know, I think to say that there's good news when individuals, families, and businesses, you know, are seeing these rates would be a little disrespectful. So I won't do that. But what I will say is that if we hadn't have done the hard work that has occurred in the state by healthcare professionals, by providers, to work to bend the cost curve, the rates would be much higher. They are what they are at this point. You know, we need to check and see what we think of their assumptions, which we will do, as I said, over the next 3 months.
So as you look at the Vermont rate and the moderate rate of growth, what is Vermont doing right?
You know, that's a great question. I think what Vermont is doing right is, you know, I've described this before. I think we have a very unique time in Vermont right now in terms of the medical landscape. We've had a coalition of the willing, is what I call it, of CEOs, CFOs of hospitals, the insurance companies, FQHCs, independent docs, that have all begun the work on very creative ways to integrate care, to improve care for people, that will and does ultimately cost less. And so, so far, the Coalition of the Willing is staying together, and great progress is being made. But I've said publicly, you know, it doesn't make for a very good bumper sticker. You know, I mean, integrate care now. You know, I just don't see people, rallying around it. But it's the real hard work that has to occur to actually bend the cost curve and improve health care for Vermonters.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Rick in Plymouth. Hi, Rick. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a few comments on that. I think what a lot of folks aren't concentrating on is the overall picture of not only the health care, but the financial crisis overall that Vermonters are suffering right now under the Shumlin administration. I think the health care companies have to raise costs because, small businesses are being driven out of business, but not only because of health care, because of the real estate tax issue and all these other tax burdens they're piling on Vermonters. And part of it is, Vermont's losing jobs left and right and replacing them with less than minimum wage jobs, and people work 30 hours or less.
So, Rick, let me just interrupt you to say, how do you think the other cost pressures on small businesses translate directly to the health insurance costs?
Because I know specifically there's a few, let's just say, restaurants and small businesses in Plymouth that have gone out of business because with all these other added tax burdens, this health care issue is just, it's killing them. They're being forced to provide health care for employees that they shouldn't have to at this point, or let them find other alternatives. So I think you got to look at the overall health of the Vermont economy and what other pressures are pushing these healthcare companies to raise their rates in order to stay in business in the state. It's just, you can't keep taking and not give anything back.
Okay, Rick, we appreciate your phone call. You're a small business person.
Sure. So what I would say is that, to talk about the healthcare portion of what Rick was talking about, that's why I got involved. I think that the increases in health insurance that we've seen, since I've been in business, which was, almost 18 years ago, we bought our first restaurant, and the increases that we've seen, we simply can't afford, and they're not sustainable. And so that's why I got involved. And, as I commented on earlier, the last 2 years of data that we have, Vermont is below the national average of growth, and its growth in medical inflation is just below 2% for the 2 years. That's good news to small businesses. It's not showing up in these rates, and I realize that.
Let's talk to Ron, who's calling from Irisburg. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Obviously, this healthcare problem is incredibly complex, and Mr. Gobet has been able to see it after, many hours and weeks and months of deliberation. I would like to hear his definition of the problem that we're trying to solve, because so much of this discussion focuses on the symptoms of the problem and not the cause of the problem. So I would like to hear simply his statement, hopefully it's within one or two sentences, of the definition of the problem we're trying to solve with this health care reform. And I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ron.
That's an awful big challenge. Two sentences. Let me try to do that. So what I would say is that we have a system of collecting and paying for health care in our state and in our country that is inefficient and actually drives up costs and at times leads to bad health outcomes. And that's how I would frame it.
We got an email from someone named Mark who wants to know, what would happen if the Green Mountain Care Board, because you'll be reviewing the insurance rate increases, what would happen if you said, isn't going to happen, you know, where we're limiting hospitals to a 3% increase next year? You know what, Blue Cross and MVP? You're not getting any more than 3% either. What would happen?
So while I can't talk about these particular cases, let me just explain some of the competing, what I call competing priorities. So no one wants to have insurance companies, health insurance companies, run out of money, become insolvent, go bankrupt, because we would have all paid in, and then we would get sick at some point during the year, and they would be without the resources to cover those claims. That has happened. That is a very bad thing for the state and for the people affected. So as a regulator, solvency has to be, solvency of the company has to be a priority for our one of our lenses. That said, affordability is one of the lenses we look through as well. And so sometimes those compete. And if you were to say, you know, we just can't imagine that this rate is adequate or necessary, and you turned it down, you would have to understand the effect it would have on the company. And if you did that over a period of time, the company would run out of money, and we would create a whole new crisis that would be awful.
Let's talk to Robin in Fairfield. Hi, Robin. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'd like to touch on three points. One, a 10% increase. From 1995 forward until 2007, I was the administrator for a construction company, and 10% increase was nothing out of the ordinary. I think you'll find that actually there was a couple of times when it was around 14% increase. Second, I'd like to touch base on the fact that there was no proof of income required for signing up for the Affordable Health Care Act, and I question that. When I called, I actually said, how can you do this without proving someone's income? And third, if the pricing for health care in the health care facility was, if you had a clue what things were going to cost, you could shop around. But it's the only place that I know where you're pretty much forced to buy something and have no idea what the cost is until you get a bill. Those are my comments.
Okay, Robin, thanks very much. How much difference would it make if you could get the cost ahead of time? Do you think that the healthcare field, at least some aspects of it, are open to sort of a consumer marketplace?
You know, there's been states that have done some of that work, you know, tried to put a map, you know, where you could click on different hospitals and see what different competing procedures might cost. We're actually doing some work on that now. And, you know, certainly price transparency would be a great thing. I also think quality would be a great thing. You know, what we want, let me be clear, we want competition in healthcare, but we want them to compete on quality. The idea that they're competing on something else, it could lead to a healthcare system that we don't really enjoy.
Today in the program, our guest is the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobay. We're talking about healthcare in Vermont, some new rate increases that have been proposed, other aspects of the healthcare system as the Green Mountain Care Board looks ahead to 2017 and perhaps implementing a single-payer system. What are your thoughts? Send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. With me today, Al Gobay, who is the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board. We're talking about healthcare in Vermont. 1-800-639-2211 if you've got a question or a comment. Once again, 1-800-639-2211. Al, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the cost of policies sold on the Vermont Exchange are the fifth highest in the country. And that's an apples-to-apples comparison, because you could say, well, here's the silver policy that's for sale in Vermont. Here's the silver policy that's for sale in New Mexico. fifth highest, and Vermont is roughly 25% higher than the national average. And yet at the same time, Vermont is right at the top of the list as one of the healthiest states in the country. We see that all the time. So I got to believe a lot of listeners are wondering, what's going on here? Why are the rates here so high, so much higher than the rest of the country?
So when you say it's apples to apples, I would push back on that a little bit. You know, there's a lot that goes into building a rate, an insurance rate. You know, one of the main drivers is the age of the population that's insured, because obviously the older we get, the larger our health care needs are typically. Vermont being the second oldest state, that certainly has an effect on rates. Another point is that our health care benefit, the benefit that's in the exchange, is richer than most states. And so it's important to compare dollars, but it's also important to compare what you're buying.
Let's turn to Richard in Perkinsville. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask about administrative costs in the system. I have been a physician for about 40 years in Vermont, and I think one of the biggest changes that's occurred, and hopefully it's for the better, is that there have been more and more, at least visible to physicians, layers of sort of administrative duties and jobs and whatnot, and seem to be now supervisors and supervisors of supervisors, and the corporate compliance area has gotten very big with a lot of people. And I'm finding with the electronic health records, for which I think there are many advantages, and I use one myself, that all of a sudden things are getting complicated in terms of reporting meaningful use, such that we're going to need kind of contractors to come in and kind of go over how we're using them and provide a lot of data. Very much, it kind of reminded me the other day of how when you do income tax, you need to have an accountant. Well, now we're going to need to have this level of administration come in. And I'm impressed also that the administrators in the health business, be they working for Blue Cross or be they working for small community hospitals, end up with really the highest paying jobs in the system. And I'm just wondering, is somebody tracking the cost of this and looking at that? Because it seems to just be mushrooming out of control. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call. We also got an email from Brooks in Jericho who wants to know what percentage of the proposed premium increases is for executive compensation, administrative costs, and for marketing, the same kind of line. How does this work?
So first, let's define administrative costs. I think that would be helpful. Typically, we talk about administrative costs at the insurance company during the rate review process. And so what we've seen is actually Blue Cross's percentage of admin fall in the last couple of years. I believe it was as high as 9. If I'm wrong, forgive me, but it was up there. And now it's in the middle 6s. And so we've seen, you know, that number improve. MVPs, I believe, is just under 9. But they have a smaller population, so that can be problematic of the equation. But so that's the administrative cost of the insurance company, which we would like to see come down because, you know, I agree with the caller. The second administrative costs are those within the healthcare system, within the delivery system, and they have grown over the last 10 years. And the way that we attempt to control those is through our hospital budget process. And so by setting a target on growth, that limits the amount, you know, of obviously of hiring and other expenses that you can have. So that puts them on a trend that they have to manage under, but we don't get into the specifics of individual people or pay because, we're talking about a $2.1 billion system. That would be awful hard to do. It's better to manage it from the top end. And we have seen a tremendous, moderation of the cost from that process. So I think what we're doing is working, but the caller makes a very good point.
Let's talk to Paul in Essex. Hi, Paul. What's on your mind today?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Earlier, Al had brought up the topic of reserves needed for insurance companies to stay solvent, make sure that we've got a claim that actually gets paid. And I was curious, Al, if you had an idea of kind of what the two insurance companies, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and MVP have right now, for reserves, and if we're going to have a single-payer system that's going to be active paying benefits starting January 1st of 2017, how much money does the state need to accumulate to have the kind of reserves that insurance companies need today to be solvent?
Those are great questions. Let me start with MVP and kind of with the way this works. The Department of Financial Regulation, by statute, is supposed to provide to the Green Mountain Care Board a statement of solvency for the insurance companies that we regulate. And so they vet MVP and Blue Cross, and it's a very complicated model that they use in order to explain to us the solvency of these entities. For MVP, because they're a New York entity, that is done in cooperation with New York State, and MVP is a big company in New York, and we don't get into that too much, so I don't have their New York data. But for Blue Cross Blue Shield, the way I would express it is, they have about a month's reserves for every covered life, and that's just my quick math that I was able to do. It totals, over $100 million when you add it all up, but they need that reserve, some level of reserve, and it can be debated, in order to be, solvent. What I would say is that, and Blue Cross is a very healthy company. What I would say is that that when it comes to looking at, these entities, it's important to remember that there's always competing priorities in terms of affordability and in the other items I've mentioned, but no one wants insurance companies to falter, and I just want to reiterate that.
When you look at efforts to contain costs, let me just give you a very simplistic idea, okay? What you really need to do is reduce the utilization of the most expensive medical procedures. That's where the money is. There have been some surveys and studies that look at that. Is that the case? I mean, is that what the goal really needs to do here is keep people healthier, reimburse the healthcare providers for keeping people healthy so that these really expensive procedures aren't necessary?
You're hitting one of the nails right on the head. I mean, that's what we're talking about, is that if you have a great relationship with your primary care doctor or nurse, and if you are doing the right things at the right time in terms of caring for yourself under their supervision, then these big moments don't have to happen as often. So that certainly is a part of it, but there's other pieces.
Do we have a healthcare system now that allows providers to be reimbursed for keeping their patients healthy, as opposed to only dealing and getting paid when their patients are sick?
Pieces of the healthcare system are paid sort of in the way you describe, but certainly not the majority. And so that would be one of the goals, is paying hospitals for keeping people healthy is a much better way to go than paying every step of the way as people are sick. Those are tough moves, though, and they require a lot of analysis and a lot of cooperation between the entities. And so that is a lot of what we work on.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Bob in Moncton. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Great.
So I heard Mr. Gobay mention earlier about bending the cost curve and having better care. And I just want to let you know that I run a small business, and we bought a policy for myself and some of my employees at Exchange. And we chose our policies based on dollar amount to try to match the policy we had before through Blue Cross. And our experience has been, we bought a policy that was similar in dollar amount, but the benefits have been less. And now with the increase, the 10% of the 14% increase, actually our policy is going to cost more and our benefits are going to be less. So it seems like, the cost curve certainly isn't bending down and the care is less. So it doesn't seem to fit with the comment that was made earlier. And I also want to mention that the amount of paperwork I get from a hospital, I had a couple incidents this year that I was hospitalized, and is incredible. There's a bill for the radiologist, a bill for the specialist, a bill. It just, the amount of paperwork I get in the mail after, either going to the doctor or going to the hospital is amazing. It just seems like there could be some savings there somehow. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, Bob, thanks for your call. I think what Bob is saying, and we've heard this from a lot of people on this program over the last 6 months, is that maybe they could pay for a comparable policy on the exchange, but then they find out that the out-of-pocket cap is much, much higher than they ever had before. And so if they do have to utilize the healthcare system, they're on the hook for a lot of money.
Yeah, I can certainly understand where Bob's coming from. I think that what he describes as the benefit is what you're talking about as the cost sharings, copays, and deductibles. And when you look at the bronze plan in the exchange for an individual, it's over $6,000 for the total aggregate of what I just described, and that has, that has hit people hard. And I think that, when we talk about what do we want from our healthcare system, we need to be able to afford care that is not only a catastrophic payment. And to some of the folks that have bought products in the exchange, that's the way it feels, and I realize that.
Let's talk to Fred in Waterbury. Hi, Fred. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
My comment earlier, Mr. Gobet had mentioned, in defining the problem as being the inefficiency in the system of collecting and paying for health care, and it's leading to bad outcomes. And I guess I have a couple of thoughts. No one, of course, I think, can come up with a solution that will cover all of the problems, is I think it's multifaceted and each one needs to be tackled and they work together. But one of them, with regard to employers being required to provide health insurance or to pay for health care for their employees, I'd be considered a liberal, but I have views that border on conservative and libertarian as well. And I don't think that any business should be responsible for its employees' health care. Whether it's a car company or McDonald's or an attorney's law office or any other company, that's the business that they're in and not the business of providing health insurance. And so if somehow in this system of collecting and paying for health care, we remove the requirement that employers provide it, somehow that money that was being paid needs to be redirected elsewhere. But one place that could be considered is, with that extra income, perhaps that's where increasing the minimum wage to make health insurance more affordable to employees to buy their own health insurance, where the numbers start working out. Another thought that I had in listening to the dialogue is I find that it seems more and more we're just gravitating towards that self-payer, single-payer system, and that the real problem in this, in part, or one problem, a significant problem, is the role of insurance companies, because they're simply acting as an intermediary between the people who have the money and need to pay for services. They do paperwork, they have their administrative costs, the marketing and everything that goes into them, and then at the end of it, a little bit less money is available for the healthcare providers, who in turn are each trying to get as much as they can. And so it's step by step, but I would say the one first step would be, how do we minimize the role of insurance companies and their ability to, kind of skim money off of the top of the whole system? And so before I leave, I'll take one aside.
Very briefly, Fred, because we've got another call we have to get to.
That no one wants insurance companies to go up, and I would disagree, and I would say that if we could get insurance companies out of the system, we may all be a little bit better off. But thanks for taking my call.
Okay, let's turn to Marguerite in Weston. Hi, Marguerite.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Okay, my first question is, given all the problem that Vermont Health Connect has had getting rolling, and we're looking at the single payer coming in between 2015 and 2017, it seems a very complicated thing to handle in a very short period of time. Has any thought been given to delaying the start of the single payer? And my other question is, suppose I break my leg when I'm skiing in Colorado. How does single payer pay for me there?
Okay, we've just got a couple of minutes left. What about the problems that Vermont Health Connect has had? We don't have a financing plan yet. The governor isn't going to do that until next year. Is 2017 realistic?
You know, I don't believe this should be done on a calendar. You know, I've said that. I think that the plan that was originally built when Act 48 was created was so much more than a financing plan. You know, it created the Green Mountain Care Board and put us on a path to try to moderate the cost of health care in Vermont. And so we've been on that path now for almost 3 years, and I can point to some tangible results. The work that we're doing to moderate cost, you have to do that. You have to work on the payment delivery system before you would want to come up with a financing plan. Because the question becomes, what are you financing? You know, I think that if we had rushed to a financing plan without having what I would refer to as a payment delivery plan, that would not have been wise. I want to answer one question she had, the Colorado point. You know, the way that Blue Cross works is they're part of a network, and that's why you're covered in Colorado. And so there would have to be some component in any plan that we had that would allow that type of coverage. So
you were talking about cost containment, and you really need to address those issues first. And the governor has said on many occasions, if we don't get costs under control, we're not going down the road to single payer. I guess sort of to follow from Marguerite's question, we've got about 45 seconds left. Do you think you're going to have all that cost containment, those initiatives in place, so that by 2017, it's realistic for the state to implement single payer?
I think it's too early to tell right now, but the conversations that we're having across the state are going well. And so, you know, we're not doing the cost control to meet the 2017 date. We're working on cost control and doing it right and being very careful with what we're doing, because we're talking about the health of Vermonters here. And so we want to go through every necessary step possible to change to a payment system that builds the delivery system that we want. And so we're doing that. We want this to be done by provider leadership, not by, you know, just, you know, Green Mountain Care Board leadership. And so it's going to take time. I don't know how much time.
Been a great discussion. We want to thank you for being on the program. You got to come back in a couple of months and update us on other initiatives that are taking place.
I would love to come. If I could just quickly say, if you have comments, gmcb.board@state.vt.us. You can make them to us on anything you heard today, or on especially on the rate cases we have.
And we'll have a link to that at our website as well.
Fantastic.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Senator Patrick Leahy about a possible constitutional amendment that would overturn the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. This week, the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington held a hearing on a proposed constitutional amendment that would overturn recent Supreme Court rulings dealing with money and politics. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy is the chairman of that committee, and he has some very strong views on this subject. Senator Leahy, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
So this week you said, quote, left unanswered, these rulings will continue to erode fundamental aspects of our democratic process. Why do you think that's true?
Well, I think one of the witnesses we had made it very clear that in his state, because of a special interest that really wanted to change things for their company and their friends, they basically took over the legislature, they took over the governor's office, and they changed the law. You know, we had this back in the last century, and that's why they changed to the popular election of senators, because in Montana, one company owned the legislature, and they determined who's going to be in the Senate. But I think we've reached a point where, especially if you're from a large state, you're in terrible shape in trying to run unless you got special interests and give you money.
Well, a majority of the justices on the Supreme Court concluded in the Citizens United case that campaign contributions really amount to free speech. Are they wrong?
I don't see money as being free speech. I see free speech as being free speech. And that means that if you're somebody who's working as a clerk in a store, or you're the head of the company that owns the store, you each have a right to speak. Nobody should stop that. But if money determines how much you're heard, then the owner of the store has a bigger voice than the clerk who works at it. And that's not what the framers of the country expected. I mean, in Citizens United, they basically said a corporation is a citizen. That's as foolish as saying we elect General Eisenhower as president, then why can't we elect General Electric as president? If it wasn't for the natural-born citizen in the Constitution, they'd probably say that. But corporations are not individuals. They don't vote. And if you say they can spend any kind of money they want, in a way you're saying, yeah, but we're going to let you have a backdoor vote. I think that's wrong. I think Citizens United overturned decades of precedent. We ought to have open debates. We ought to have people be able to speak, whether they're challengers or incumbents. But their speech shouldn't be determined by how much money they have.
Senator, there are also some additional campaign finance cases that are working their way through the court system and are likely to end up at the Supreme Court. How concerned are you that the current court might just strike down all laws that place any limits on campaign contributions?
The rate they're going at, I would not be surprised that they did. I think it'd be a horrible mistake. I look at my own case. If we had these rules back when I ran for the Senate, I never would have been elected. I wouldn't have been able to come up with the money. As it is, I've had a number of my elections where I was outspent by people on the other side. We had because they could bring in this money, and that's before there's so much money in the system. Now, what you're going to have is if some of these large groups want to take over the delegation from a small state, they can spend all the money they want. That's why when we had the Disclose Act, which would have at least brought about some transparency so you know where the money is coming from, every single Republican filibustered it, including Senator McCain, who was very proud of the McCain-Feingold law. You know, at least know where the money is coming from. Now you have, for example, Citizens for Clean Environment. It may be paid for by a company, Polluters R Us, for all you know. You have no way of knowing. It sounds like a motherhood and apple pie, and it may be an extreme group, and I don't care if that's on the right or the left. They should not have the ability to hide behind their money.
You know, Senator, it's interesting. I just discovered a tape that's 26 years old of former Senator Robert Stafford when he spoke to the Vermont legislature in his final year as being a U.S. senator, and he warned the legislature to look out for the influence of special interests and special interest money.
Single-issue politics is threatening not only the business of running for public office today, but it's a threat to the operation of government itself. Campaigns are financed by special interests more and more. And finally, there's the danger that special interests of legislatures and those in charge of administering government take precedence over the interests of the nation as a whole.
In this case, he's absolutely right. I don't care if the special interest is on the far right or on the far left. It should be the individuals who are running who should determine what the issues are, not some special interest group that has all kinds of money to spend. you know, have open debates between the candidates. Let the press follow them around and hear what they have to say. Don't let it be done just because somebody can call up $10 million worth of attack ads and they win. That doesn't do any good for the people in that state.
Now, Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, in looking at this idea of having a proposed constitutional amendment, said this, quote, Senate Democrats are seeking unfettered power to regulate and stifle political speech, and once Congress can prohibit spending money, it can prohibit almost every form of speech, whether it comes to books, films, television advertisements, or events. What do you say to him?
Well, you know, Senator Cruz is running for president. He likes making dramatic statements, whether they have any basis in fact or not, and this is one of them. Of course, that's not the case any more than we could, the Congress could pass a law that says only the citizens of these five states can vote in the next presidential election. It'd be as foolish as that. It can't be done. It won't be done. The fact is, however, he is one of the ones who support having secret money in campaigns. I don't believe in that. At the very least, if people are going to spend money in a campaign, then you ought to know who it's coming from. I've always declared every single cent. In fact, I had one disclosure once of somebody who contributed like 35 or 45 cents. It costs us more than that to just disclose it, but that's the rule I have. And we ought to know who is giving you money. But Senator Cruz is one of those who advocates having secret money in a campaign. I totally disagree with him.
Senator, the process to amend the Constitution is long and quite complicated, and it starts with a two-thirds vote in both the Senate and the House. And given the current makeup of Congress, isn't it very, very unlikely that the House would ever give its strong approval to this proposed amendment?
Well, I don't think the House would give strong approval to anyone that proposed constitutional amendments, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't start the debate. You know, we had that same debate for years, whether you would allow 18-year-olds to vote, whether you'd allow women to vote, whether you would do away with prohibition, whether you'd give equal rights to both blacks and whites. It took years of debating until we finally got it. And maybe if there's enough attention given to this, the Supreme Court may start rethinking some of the extreme positions they've taken.
Senator Patrick Leahy, many thanks for being on the program today.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Well, this week, Senator Bernie Sanders spoke about the VA healthcare scandal and compared it to problems facing the rest of the U.S. healthcare system. Congressman Peter Welch, meanwhile, praised President Obama's announcement that emissions from coal-fired power plants must be reduced in the coming years. In Vermont's forests, efforts continue to slow the advance of an invasive insect, the emerald ash borer. Governor Peter Shumlin unveiled an effort to attract skilled workers from out of state. The Slow Living Summit got underway in Brattleboro to promote sustainable, holistic lifestyles. And a massive hailstorm hit Rutland, followed by the arrival of traveling dent repair experts to fix damaged cars. These are some of the voices in the news this week.
What happened in Phoenix and elsewhere, horrendous, unacceptable, has to be dealt with. But we have to also understand that in America, not everybody can walk into their doctor's office tomorrow and get good quality, affordable health care.
The coal plants are contributing immensely to the carbon footprint, and we've got to make adjustments there. What the president is doing, I think, number one, focusing attention on this problem is real. We're having wild weather events in Vermont and all around the country, and every day we wait makes solving this much more difficult.
Our strategy in Vermont is not to eradicate, but simply to slow down the spread of emerald ash borer.
Today, our challenge is different. It is finding enough skilled workers to do the work that we have in a job market that is growing and thriving.
The urban environment is often the best environment for slow living because there are so many ways that we can conserve resources and share resources instead of more purchases and more carbon footprint.
I'm a PDR technician, a hail technician. We repair hail-damaged vehicles across the U.S. My home is in Massachusetts, and during the course of a hail season, I call many, many places home.
That's our program for today. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.